And now, the season finale. Chapter 24, As Long as the World Shall Last. And so here we are, the season finale. The third season of the Hymen Podcast has been one of the hardest I've had to write. I've had to delve into places I never thought I would have to, and in the process, I've been trying to live my best life to the best of my ability, and while I believe I've succeeded, I'm sure there are some who would argue the complete opposite. I often talk about the power of building communities and fostering relationships, and while I believe I do that, I'm always questioning whether or not I actually fit into the community or if I'm even deserving of the love they show. While it wasn't a perfect life by any stretch of the imagination, I did spend quite some time building a life in Ohio, and to be ripped away from that only to have to start over, it has in some ways changed me. What used to be important just simply isn't anymore, and now I have this whole new monumental task ahead of me, finding the place I fit in, and not just finding that place, but being comfortable in that place. Sounds easy enough, doesn't it? It's like balancing a world of things in your arms, all the while trying to be king of the hill. And we've all played that game, and you know what they say. Heavy is the head that wears the crown. From the Hymen blog and the Press Play Podcast Network, I'm J.D. Hymen. As a black man living here in America, I am living proof that while all men were created equal, not all men are equal. We're here to dig into the American political system, explore and unearth experiences from the human condition, and be a catalyst for some hard conversations that need to be had. Conversations that demand to be had. No matter what brought you here, I'm glad you came. Once again, my name is JD, and this is the Hymen Podcast. Part 1. Effectum Moralis. Whether we choose to believe it or not, life has two absolutes. Heroes and villains. The good guys and the bad guys. I know it sounds insane, but hear me out. We live in a world where there are literally good people and bad people, and that's not to say the bad people are evil, maybe they're just savagely selfish. And that's not to say the good people help every person they happen past on the street, maybe they're just really altruistic. But that isn't the point. The point is that we're oftentimes put in these camps by other people, and sometimes we put people in these camps. And sometimes putting people in those camps have nefarious intentions. They used to say America was built on the backs of hardworking Americans. Some would argue it was built on the backs of slaves. Others would argue it was built by the working class. And there are those who would attest that it was built by the titans of corporations and the captains of industries. For me, things are never that simple. The world as we know it was built from the ground up by people who chased one aspiration after the next. The Titanic, for example, was one aspiration after the next. And when you think about it, the detail that went into the Titanic, down to the 3 million rivets that were used to piece it together, it was acclaimed as the unsinkable ship. But like most things that claim to be impervious, it had one fatal flaw. The bulkheads. On ships, bulkheads serve two main purposes. One, to reinforce the hull, and two, to separate the ship into watertight compartments. This was necessary in the event one compartment was flooded, the ship could remain afloat since the damage would be contained to this one area. In the case of the RMS Titanic, it was separated into 16 different compartments. However, by design, the bulkheads only extended up to E-deck, which unfortunately was only 30 feet above the waterline. You see, when the ship struck the iceberg, the sharp ice pierced and sliced open 6 of the watertight compartments. The Titanic was designed such that the first 4 compartments could flood and the buoyancy of the ship would even out and keep the ship afloat. But with 6 compartments damaged, the bulkheads only extending to E-deck, the water created a domino effect. As one compartment would fill with water, it would spill over the tops of the bulkhead and into the next compartment. They would flood and continue back. As the water flooded the vessel, the weight was so great that it actually pulled the stern out of the water. I'm sure you've all seen the movie or that iconic scene of the Titanic stern lifted up out of the water. The stress of this on the ship's hull caused the keel to snap, which split the ship in two. And it wasn't a clean break. A portion of the keel was still intact. The stern fell back into the water, but the steel connected bow continued to flood. And as it flooded, it began to sink, and in the process, it pulled the stern with it, drawing it back out of the water. At this point, the stern was completely vertical, and with the bow fully submerged, the weight caused it to break away from the stern, nosediving towards the ocean floor. For a few moments, the stern bobbed in the water, but it too quickly flooded, and it wasn't long before it also sank. The Titanic was gone, perished. The steel-occupied ship and those who made it out to the deck but not on a lifeboat succumbed to the frigid waters of the North Atlantic. All in, 1,503 men, women, and children were claimed by the sea that night. The whole point is this great big thing was built. In fact, it was the largest thing ever built by the hands of man in the world at the time. This Titanic structure was designed and built with hubris and brawn, touted as unsinkable, backed by grandeur and luxury. And on its very first trip to sea, it hit an iceberg and sank. 2 hours and 40 minutes. That's how long it took the unsinkable to sink. And just like that, White Star Lines became the villain. Or at least, that's what people believe then, but we'll come back to that. While that may have seemed pretty cut and dry, let's talk about the royal family for a moment. At a polo match, Prince Charles met Camilla Shand in 1970. They discovered they had much in common and began dating. Shortly after, Charles went off to serve in the Royal Navy for 8 months, and when he returned, he learned that Camilla was engaged to Andrew Parker Bowles, who, by the way, only became engaged because the two families got together and announced the engagement, effectively forcing the issue. Still, they married and had two children. In 1977, at the age of 28, Charles met 16-year-old Lady Diana Frances Spencer while dating her older sister, Sarah. Notwithstanding, the relationship was short-lived, and in 1980, he started dating Diana. A year later, in 1981, with an estimated 750 million people tuning in around the world, the two were wed. And just like that, Her Royal Highness Diana, the Princess of Wales, came to be. They had two sons, Prince William, born in 1982, and Prince Harry, born in 1984. Charles, however, wasn't over his ex, Camilla, and in 1986, they began an affair. Charles and Diana, despite their best efforts, or as best we know, were not able to salvage their relationship, and a reluctant Queen Elizabeth II approved the two to divorce in 1996. Charles wasted no time in trying to legitimize his relationship with Camilla, but she was already divorced, which was an affront to the church, and as such, the Queen would not offer her blessing for another 4 years. In an attempt to ingratiate himself with the royal family, billionaire Egyptian businessman Mohammed Al-Fayed convinced his son, Dodi Al-Fayed, who was a film producer, to court and date the Princess of Wales following her divorce from Charles. It was speculated that it was he who was responsible for the paparazzi that began to follow the couple's every move in an effort to legitimize the relationship, but in actuality, they were first spotted by pure luck by Mario Brenna. After Brenna's photos were published, over 2,000 photographers descended on the Mediterranean, attempting to join in on the action. Mohammed wanted Dodi to propose to Diana following a summer fling spent aboard his yacht in the French Riviera. On August 30th, 1997, while en route to London, the couple made a stop in Paris for the night. But they were quickly welcomed by the paparazzi. They left for the Hotel Ritz, which was owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed. The couple's next stop was Dodi's apartment, which was just a short distance away. In order to evade the paparazzi, a decoy car departed from the front of the hotel while the princess and Dodi made their exit from the rear. Henri Paul, deputy head of security at the Ritz, was instructed to drive the armored 1994 Mercedes-Benz S-Class with Dodi's personal bodyguard, Trevor Rees-Jones, in the front passenger seat. Diana was in the rear passenger seat, Dodie on the driver's side. As they took their leave, it didn't take long before a throng of photographers were on their tail. Paul accelerated the vehicle as they entered the Pont de l'Alma tunnel at twice the posted speed limit. At 12:23 a.m. the morning of August 31st, Henri Paul sideswiped a Fiat inside the tunnel before completely losing control of the vehicle, which then collided into a pillar. The vehicle hit with such force that the entire front end fanned inward like an accordion. Henri Paul and Dodie Al-Fayed were killed instantly upon impact. Diana, surprisingly, was still conscious, and so was Trevor Rees-Jones. The first person on the scene was actually an off-duty physician who rushed over to help. He noted that the driver and driver's side passenger were non-responsive and that Rees-Jones was in audible pain. Knowing the man was still conscious, he turned his attention to the final passenger, Diana. He noted that she didn't have any visible injuries, but it would soon turn out that looks can be quite deceiving. Paramedics arrived at the scene within 5 minutes. The princess was assessed and extricated from the vehicle. One of the firefighters who helped free her heard her say, "My God, what has happened?" These would be the last words spoken by the princess. Diana was sedated and soon after went into cardiac arrest. Paramedics were able to revive her and rush her to the hospital. Upon arrival, Diana lost consciousness again. In surgery, they would learn the true extent of her injuries. She'd suffered from a concussion, a dislocated shoulder, a laceration to the thigh, but her more serious injuries, however, would later prove to be fatal. Her heart had been displaced to the right side of her chest, which tore the upper left pulmonary vein and pericardium. Surgeons were able to repair her heart, but after 2 hours of a combination of defibrillation and internal cardiac massage, the princess never regained consciousness. Diana, Princess of Wales, having suffered blunt force chest trauma and massive internal bleeding, succumbed to her injuries. She was pronounced dead at approximately 3 a.m. on August 31st. The Prince of Wales, along with her sisters, traveled to Paris to repatriate Diana's body back to London. The princess was laid to rest in Northampton at the Spencer Estate on a small island in the center of the Round Oval Lake. While many factors contributed to the death of the woman who would come to be known as the People's Princess, including Dodie's excursion, neither of them having worn seatbelts, the pursuit by the paparazzi. In the end, Operation Paget, the official British Metropolitan Police inquest into her death, would lay the blame on Henri Paul, who was reported to have been driving while 3 times over the French legal limit of alcohol in his blood. The legacy of the Princess of Wales lives on to this day. She was beloved by her country, the world, and her 2 sons. While the princess lived an eccentric life, it was not without anguish. For Diana, the royal treatment was anything but royal, and despite the crown attempting to shape her into a prim and proper princess, Diana sought to find her own footing. She made her name for herself through various charities and philanthropic ventures, and she did so with the grace and kindness she so deeply saw in everyone she encountered. She met many people, but was a hero to so many more. But when it comes to actual heroes, there are stories like Captain Chelsea Sullenberger, more formally known as Captain Sully. He was a now retired U.S. Airways pilot that encountered a bird strike shortly after taking off from LaGuardia Airport in New York City. U.S. Airways Flight 1549, flying under the call sign Cactus 1549, took off from Newark's LaGuardia Airport and cleared runway 4 at 3:24 p.m. Eastern Time en route to Charlotte Douglas International Airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, with First Officer Jeffrey Skiles at the helm. The plane was an Airbus A320, which was powered by twin CFM International CFM56-5B4 turbofan engines. At approximately 3:27 p.m., 3 minutes after takeoff during climbout at 2,818 feet, the plane struck a flock of Canadian geese, about 4.5 miles north-northwest of LaGuardia. The bird strike caused catastrophic double-engine failure. For 19 seconds, the aircraft slowed but continued to rise, reaching an altitude of 3,060 feet. Sully, a seasoned pilot, retook control of the aircraft and quickly weighed out his options. Air traffic control attempted to redirect Sully back to LaGuardia. Sully managed to turn the plane around, but without the engines, Sully knew it was too risky to try and navigate the plane across Midtown New York. He inquired about Teterboro Airport, a small relief airport in New Jersey. Air traffic control cleared him for landing, but Sully quickly determined that he would not be able to navigate the aircraft safely into New Jersey airspace. Knowing that he couldn't turn back or divert back to LaGuardia or JFK, and that he couldn't make it over to New Jersey, he was left with no choice but to land in a scenario he had been trained for, but hoped he would never have to perform. A water landing. Coming to grips with the inevitability of the situation, Sully piloted the aircraft center over the Hudson River, passing a mere 900 feet over the George Washington Bridge. After double and triple checking with his co-pilot, First Officer Jeffrey Skiles, that they had exhausted all attempts at restarting the engines, he reached for the intercom and gave the cabin and crew one command: brace for impact. The cabin crew jumped into action, preparing the passengers for a scenario they too were trained for but hoped to never participate in. Brace, brace, brace. Heads down, stay down. They repeated the command in unison ad nauseum, and they would do so just until before the aircraft touched down into the water. A water landing, you might think, would be smooth. The underbelly of the plane, after all, would glide across the surface of the water, and you would be wrong. A water landing is anything but smooth. It's quite jarring, actually. At 3:31 p.m., the aircraft made an unpowered ditching, descending southwards at 125 knots or 140 miles per hour into the middle of the North River section of the Hudson Tidal Estuary. I know I've mentioned tidal estuaries in a previous episode, but I'll reiterate. The Hudson River flows from upstate New York, originating near the Catskills, and terminates in the Atlantic Ocean. While it is a river upstate, by the time it reaches Manhattan Island, it's a tidal estuary, meaning in certain places it's deeper than the water it flows into. As soon as the plane had come to a halt, the flight attendants quickly disarmed and ejected the overwing exits, and at the same time, they opened forward doors and inflated the emergency slides. Once all the passengers were safely on the wings and slides, Captain Sully checked the plane twice before dropping down on the slide himself. They disconnected the slides from the fuselage, which made them life rafts, and waited for rescuers to arrive. New York is one of those cities that has seen tragedy one too many times, and in the absence of thought, two New York waterway ferries and the U.S. Coast Guard quickly responded. They ferried the passengers to nearby docks where 140 New York firefighters were waiting to accept the injured. Of the 150 passengers and five crew members on board, there were no fatalities. Captain Sullenberger was hailed as a hero for this amazing feat, and it wasn't until the NTSB began to investigate that the airline industry and its regulators really understand the astonishment of what Captain Sully was able to do. More on that after the break.
Hello, Brooks here with the Books with Brooks monthly book club podcast. Here's how Books with Brooks works. We read one book a month and then we talk about it. Classics like Stephen King's The Shining, debut novels like We Are the Brennans by Tracy Lang, and tons of other compelling, life-changing stories, one book and one month at a time. So come read along with us and then listen in.
Welcome everyone to Podcast 616, the official podcast of Earth 616. I am your host, Damon Royster, and I am inviting you to listen and subscribe to this Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast. On Podcast 616, we gather some of today's greatest comedians, writers, and actors to dive deep into all things Marvel, like comic book history and lore, all the interconnected superhero storylines, and of course, who's hot and who's not in the MCU. Honestly, why aren't you listening right now? You have the power to listen to Podcast 616. And as we always say, with great power comes even greater responsibility. Listen and subscribe to Podcast 616 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, this is Don Mike Mendoza, the host of Producing While Asian. Join us in season 2 for more conversations with actors, artists, producers, and more from Broadway, Hollywood, and beyond, every other Wednesday on the Press Play Podcast Network.
Part 2, The Stuff of Heroes. If you've seen the movie Sully, then you most likely have a misguided interpretation of the events that actually happened following the events that would come to be known as the Miracle on the Hudson. Movies have to have drama, and in the film, they took some liberties by making the NTSB out as prosecutors who were attempting to place the blame on Sully. In the film, the NTSB contested Sully's decision to make the water landing as opposed to returning to LaGuardia or nearby Teterboro. Also in the film, and in real life, they used flight simulators to determine whether or not Sully had made a miscalculation. In the penultimate moment in the film, Sully suggests that the investigators did a fantastic job in their investigation. He concluded that the investigation was thorough and by the book. He then interjected with a simple fact that in real life was suggested by one of the NTSB investigators, the human factor. In the flight simulations, the pilot struck the birds and immediately turned around and returned to LaGuardia or rerouted to nearby Teterboro. And out of the 15 simulated runs, 8 of those runs were able to make the landing. But they were missing one critical thing, the human factor. The investigator noted that Sully and Skiles were unawares of the dire nature of their situation in the seconds that followed the bird strike. They went through a series of protocols to restart the engines before they realized that they were truly in an emergent situation and that they needed to return to an airport. So the flight simulator pilots were asked to include a 35-second delay following the bird strike before attempting to return to LaGuardia or reroute to Teterboro. In each of the runs with a 35-second delay, none of the pilots were able to successfully land at either airport. The inquiry board concluded that Sully made the right call. They concluded that with the information available to him, the conditions, and with his years of experience, he made the best decision, and in doing so, he saved the lives of everyone on that plane. But those are just a few examples, and you're still left wondering who's the hero and who's the villain. So what about the villains? They say that every villain has an origin story, some cataclysmic shift or event in a person's life that derailed them from all the good they were meant to do. And the thing that's left behind is a shell of a person. And it's thought that this shell is the remnants of right and wrong, but mostly wrong. For me, my villain origin story started in Ohio, but by the grace of God and maybe even sheer dumb luck, I wound up not being a villain in the end. But you can't say the same for everyone else. The world is full of villains, and where you have villains, you usually have people fighting them. I mean, look at what's going on in Israel and Gaza. A modern story of heroes and villains. But why? And how did it start? Long ago, God made a promise to Abraham and his wife Sarah. He promised them a son, an heir, who would become the father of many nations. As Abraham and Sarah grew older, Sarah remained barren, and doubting that God would not make good on his promise, she sent her maidservant Hagar to bed with Abraham. Hagar then bore a son, and he was called Ishmael. About 14 years later, God fulfilled the promise he made to Sarah as he'd always intended to. And at the age of 90, she gave birth to a son, whom she called Isaac. As the boys grew, Sarah saw how well they got along, and now she feared that Ishmael would also become an heir, and so she instructed Abraham to cast out Hagar and her son. And so the boys went their separate ways and formed their own tribes: the Jews, the sons of Isaac, and the Arabs, the sons of Ishmael. Whether rightly or wrongly, the two half-brothers spent many years apart, but in the end, history tells us that this story has a better ending, because when Abraham died, the two men came together, not as tribal leaders, but as brothers, as sons, to bury their father. Depending on your interpretation of the story, Sarah could have been seen as the villain for asking her husband to sleep with another woman to circumvent God's promise. Abraham could be the villain for listening to his wife and casting out Hagar. Or maybe the villain isn't actually any of them. Maybe the villain was time. Maybe the villain was the thought that God would not see his promise through. But more than that, it's about relationships. It's about the relationship between God and Abraham, Abraham and his wife, Abraham and his sons, and the unique relationship between Abraham's sons, Isaac and Ishmael. The brothers grew apart, they lived apart, they flourished apart. But it was that singular relationship that brought them back together. And maybe not under the most ideal circumstances, but they were brought together nonetheless. The relationship between Abraham and his sons and the relationship between Isaac and Ishmael mirror the relationships of the people in our everyday lives. They mirror our own relationships, whether romantic or platonic. Relationships serve as a hallmark of the human experience. We were designed to live and operate in a community and not within a vacuum. We were designed for relationships, and sometimes those relationships can turn us into our best selves, and sometimes they can deteriorate the very traits that make us who we are. By and large, we are viewed as someone's hero, and in some cases, arch nemesis. What we have to remember is that both the good and bad are necessary for us to exist. Sure, we could live in a world where everything was perfect, but what will that get us? The thing is, we assign these titles arbitrarily and without ever really knowing what they mean. The White Star Line Company weren't really villains. All they did was finance the building of a flawed ship. The Prince of Wales wasn't a villain. He just happened to be in love with another woman. And Diana wasn't really a hero. She was just uncharacteristically kind and generous. All the things that we expect of a princess. Sully wasn't a hero for not crashing a plane. He just did all the right things. He did what he was trained to do. Sarah wasn't a villain, she just was impatient. Sometimes we build people into heroes and villains from preconceived notions and unrealistic expectations. It's human nature, it's how we operate. To us, these people were heroes and villains, and we look to them as such. Are we supposed to wander the face of the earth ignorant to what happens around us? Are we supposed to take note of the details and get lost in them? And just as we can't exist in a world where there was only good, we cannot also exist in a world where there was only evil. And while that is true, sometimes the bad guys have to win. Sometimes bad things happen to good people. It creates balance. I believe if we never saw bad, we would never appreciate the good. The good is the one thing we can strive for. And while there is good and bad, wondrous and terrible, heroes and villains, it is up to us to recognize those things and to make the changes we must in order to preserve our little corner of sanity. Israel is under attack. They have tried to exist in this little corner of the world for nearly a century, and all the while they've had to fight back the forces of evil that have sought to do them wrong. And here recently, they have been subject to more evil and more vitriol than ever before. They are literally fighting for their lives. And while the Israelis are fighting for their independence, Russia is trying to annex Ukraine and take it as their own. And meanwhile, back in America, we're too busy fighting with each other to take notice of what's going on all around us. An old college professor, one of the smartest persons I've ever met, taught me that there is a difference between honesty and integrity. He said honesty is telling the truth, while integrity is telling the whole truth. He taught me that those who stand idly by in the presence of those who do wrong are just as culpable as the guilty actors themselves. When I look at the news or my social media feeds and I see the terrorism and its effects on the human condition, it breaks my heart. The things that mere mortals are capable of is astounding, truly. Hamas and the Russians, they all have this bleak simulacrum of what they think is a just society. And in actuality, they're just evil people doing evil things. They make the world a darker place, a grimmer place. A place where hatred is allowed to flow freely. It has been said that the hardest thing in the world is to live in it, and maybe that's true, but some people make it harder than it needs to be. For the longest time, I believed ideals and heroes were one and the same, that the people and the intrinsic things to which we assign value have the ability to stand up as idols in our lives. I believed that grace was forged and forgiveness had to be earned. But in believing that, it became evident that the people you look up to are just as flawed as any other part of our society. Our heroes, no matter who they are, like the people we love, will at some point or another let us down. As with Captain Sullenberger, I had to accept that the human factor plays a critical role in the way in which our lives turn out. The human factor is not just part of how our destiny unfolds. It is the driving force behind the very existence of everything. I don't believe in happenstance. Everything does have a purpose and meaning. Some would argue that the world is hard and that we should just wear helmets and deal with it, and they would be right. The world is hard. But I don't think a helmet is always going to solve the problem. You can cut yourself off from the world, you can attempt to shield yourself from pain and heartbreak, but as John Green so eloquently put it, pain demands to be felt. And like the water that flooded the Titanic, pain will take the path of least resistance, and when it finds you, nothing in the world can prepare you for it. Sometimes it feels like the sky is falling, like the world is tearing apart at the seams, like the light has faded away from the world. And in the absence of pragmatism, that oftentimes is reality we're all forced to reckon with. As for me, that isn't something I want for me or my future. That isn't what I want for the generations that will come after me. That isn't a reality I wish to subscribe to, because I believe in the better angels of the strangers around me. I believe that good men and women will rise up and stand up against the atrocities this world is fraught with. And I believe with every fiber of my being that even though evil has to win from time to time, that good will always prevail. Clarence Darrow once said, "As long as the world shall last, there will be wrongs. And if no man objected, and if no man rebelled, those wrongs would last forever." My name is J.D. Hyman. This is the Hyman Podcast. I'll see you next season. The Hyman Podcast was written, edited, and produced by myself. Share with guests Whitney Hall and Mary Louise Layton co-produce and research. Cover art and branding by Kevin Aki. The theme music was composed and produced by Jim Yosef with additional music license from Epidemic Sound. The Hyman Podcast is a production of the Press Play Podcast Network. Press Play is staffed by Chase Smith, our CEO and fearless leader, iService Chief Operating Officer, and Brooks May is the Chief Creative Officer. To learn more about the network, sponsorships, guest appearances, or if you're interested in launching your own podcast on our network, visit us on the web at www.pressplaypodcast.com. To learn more about this podcast, our mission and vision, or for sponsorship information, please visit us on the web at www.jdhyman.com.